I'm going to talk about the many worlds interpretation. So this is due to, or got initiated by Everett in 1957. A lot of people have worked on it in the meantime. I think, like I said yesterday, there were a couple of conferences held in 2007 to celebrate 50 years, and you can watch one of those conferences on PIRSA if you're interested in this. So one disclaimer. So what I said, I didn't have, you know, I didn't have a strong opinion. I didn't really think any of the interpretations were correct. I think in the case of the many worlds interpretation, I would say that I was an anti-advocate. So I would like to do anything possible to advocate against it. On the other hand, here is my job to teach you, to give you the best version of the many worlds interpretation I can. So I'm going to make I'm going to make the best case that I can. I'm not really an expert. I mean, there's been a lot of work done, and I haven't studied all of the literature. The version I'm going to follow is due to David Wallace, but that's based on a lot of other people's work. So with that disclaimer in place, let me begin. So here are the axioms of the many worlds approach. One, the ontic state at time t is given by the wave function. Two, the wave function evolves according to the Schrodinger equation. And that's it. The claim for people who follow this approach is that this is sufficient, and that if you now if you reason carefully, you can recover the appearances of the world. So you can use this to recover a picture in which you have tables and chairs and so on. And also you can recover the empirical content of quantum theory. So you get probabilities being given by amplitudes squared. Appearances, tables. So, like I said, there's a vast literature on the many worlds approach, and I'm going to follow the approach due to David Wallace. If you're really interested in this, then I recommend looking at his papers or the lectures that he's given. There's some on Purser, and you'll find some lectures on YouTube. He's a very good lecturer. So there's two problems. I already alluded to that have to be addressed. First question is, where does the world structure come from? So where does the appearance of tables and chairs and all the stuff that we see come from, even though the wave function appears to have this crazy superposition of all these different types of things? And in what basis? Why do we see things like tables and chairs rather than superpositions of tables and chairs? In some strange basis. So the approach that David Wallace takes here is strongly influenced by work of Simon Saunders. So David Wallace is a philosopher in Oxford, although he did his PhD he did his first PhD in physics, then his second PhD in philosophy. Simon Saunders is also a philosopher in Oxford. Then there's the approach to the recovering probability. Where does the Born rule come from? The Born rule is just that the probabilities are given by the square of the square modulus of the amplitudes. And this approach, which I'm not going to discuss in any great detail, but just to give you a flavor of it, is influenced by David Deutsch. So I mentioned yesterday that John Bell was very influenced by the de Broglie-Bohm model, coming up with his theorem, Bell's theorem, which has since had enormous applications to quantum information and other things. So David Deutsch is an advocate of the many worlds approach, and he was influenced by that in coming up with the theory of quantum computing. He really set up the framework for quantum computing in terms of circuits and so on. So it's interesting that this is another example of someone being motivated by a particular interpretation to do something which has had more practical applications. Okay. So first of all, I'm going to talk about the first problem. Where does the world structure come from and in what basis? So is this a problem? Because what we have really just these two axioms. There's no mention of world structure in there, no mention of any particular basis. So David Wallace uses decoherence to argue that at the macroscopic level, we have the emergence of quasi-classical worlds. So the idea is that at the fundamental level, there's just wave function evolving according to the Schrodinger equation. But then you have to think what it would be like to live in this world, and you know, what happens in particular at a sort of macroscopic level. And then these approximate notions of quasi-classical worlds can be seen to emerge. Well, that's the argument. This is effective structure at the macroscopic level. So to illustrate that, let's just take a simple example. So imagine we have a system, it comes in and it passes through two measurement apparatuses. Initially, the pointers are in the zero state. And then as this system passes through, you can imagine it's just a two-level system, we get measurement outcomes, which are labeled by one or two. So we perform a measurement here and a measurement here, having outcomes one or two in each case. So we can evolve the state. Initially, there's in the zero state, the wave function is coming in. And now we can evolve it past the first box. So I've just expanded the wave function coming in as a superposition of the eigenstates of the operators associated with these measurements, alpha A1 plus beta A2. And then I've passed it through this first box. And so we have A1 here and A2 there. And now we can pass it through the second box and just do the same kind of thing again. Now we have four terms. So I've expanded A1 as gamma times B1 plus delta times B2. Now this is a basis eigenstates of the observable associated with the B measurement here. And then we know that B1 and B2 are orthogonal. So we can expand B, we can expand A2. So we know that A1 and A2 are orthogonal. So we can expand A2 as an orthogonal expansion. So we have minus delta B1 plus gamma B2. And the details aren't very important, but just a way of passing it through the two boxes. Sorry, say it again. Yeah, that's right. Oh, just this is just a. Actually, probably I'm just assuming they're real. They should be. I should also be star. Come to think of it. Just if you have A1 equals gamma B1 plus delta B2 and A, this is A1 equals, let's see, is this right? Minus delta B, maybe I don't need the stars. If I take the inner products of these, I want to get zero. Let's just take the inner product. I get, if I take that, that's equal to minus delta gamma plus delta gamma, which gives me zero. That's just one way of writing down these two states as being orthogonal. Okay. So what we have here is in this evolution we have a kind of branching structure. Let me draw a diagram to make that clearer. So we have coming in, we just look at the apparatuses. We have initially the two apparatuses are in the zero state. And then we have, as the system passes through the first apparatus, we have A1, B0, or A2, P0. So after the first measurement, we kind of get this, just looking at the wave function, we get this branching. And then we get another branching. So, okay. And if we were to make many measurements sequentially rather than just two, we'd have lots and lots of branches just going on into the future. So the argument is that this branching structure is here inside the wave function emerging at a quasi-classical level. But there is a problem, which is, what is it that picks out the basis for this branching? Here I'm assuming, I'm just expanding this in the basis of the pointers of the two measurements. This is a branching structure. for the branching. To really explain why you have a particular basis in this branching structure, you need to you can invoke some extra degrees of extra environmental degrees of freedom. So these could be internal degrees of freedom inside the sort of boxes themselves, or they could be, you know, atoms floating around the boxes, whatever sort of the various environmental degrees of freedom you have around the boxes. But nevertheless, in an experiment, this box is always going to be in some physical environment. So so what you can imagine is that each of these states will interact with the environmental degrees of freedom, and this sort of interaction tends to be quite strong, so that the environment will get correlated with the box itself. So one obvious example would be if you actually had a pointer, well, that pointer would reflect light. And so the position of the pointer would be imprinted in the state of the electromagnetic field around the box. So these states of the environment corresponding to different pointer states tend to be orthogonal. So very quickly, after a very short period of time, these environment states tend to become orthogonal to each other. Any questions? I think this is clear. Well, these are degrees of freedom that will typically be there in an experiment. We're taking advantage of what is there. I mean, we're trying to describe the world as it is, and so those will be there. But then they're going to serve a particular purpose, which will be to give us a preferred basis. I'll show you how that works in a moment. So this is going to pick out a basis. So imagine you were to take a different basis. Imagine that you thought that the right basis was this one, the right basis from which we can have the branching structure is the one in which the pointers are in superpositions of being in the A1 and A2 state. So these two superpositions are orthogonal. Then, this will very quickly become entangled. With the environment. And so if we were to take these sorts of things to be the things that we see that the branching structure could be defined with respect to, we see that they're very unstable. Very quickly, they stop doing the job we want of them. Whereas the AI states remain in a product state with the environment, roughly speaking. And so they're good. Although we still haven't explained here what is it that physically distinguishes them. And if you look at models, you'll see that states that are, because the Hamiltonians that we apply here are typically local in position. So if you look at models like that, which have Hamiltonians that are local in position, they tend to take, have the behavior that a pointer state, something which is local, will interact with the environment and remain in a product state, whereas something which is a superposition of different position states, like this, will get very quickly entangled with the environment. So what's picking out the basis really here is the sorts of Hamiltonians we have, which are typically local with regard to position. So that's a matter of detailed calculation. But you can look at examples and see that this is the sort of behavior that you have.
So are you saying that the Hamiltonian ISP is a critical
state? Not the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, it's the effect of the Hamiltonian. If you look at the effect of the Hamiltonian, there's interacting these pointer states with the environment. It has this kind of behavior. So it's a matter of detailed calculation. I could give you a more detailed example, but I think we don't have time. So given this, you can see, if you also include the environment in its branching structure, you can see that this sort of structure is emergent, and you can read it off the evolution of the wave function, especially if you include the environment in here as well. I didn't in this calculation. So the argument is that at this macroscopic level, you get this approximate branching structure emerging. It's not exact. I mean, all these equations have got approximations in them. But Wallace argues that doesn't really matter because you just need to describe a sort of effective quasi-classical regime. At the fundamental level, you just have the two axioms we started with. So I think this is a reasonably good argument that this branching structure is certainly there inside the wave function.
What is the object that is branching the whole universe?
You could say like that, the whole universe. I mean, it's not fundamentally happening. Fundamentally, all that's happening is the universe, the wave function is evolving. But you can see this branching structure in the wave function. It's mathematically present there for the sorts of reasons I gave. Yeah, so that's what's happening.
Like if the wave function was given, mm-hmm. the position of so many A1, B, or N,
yeah.
I cannot follow the argument of how we can see the quasi-classical result.
For the kinds of reason I've given, that if you go through and evolve it, you get these different terms, and they're stable. As the thing interacts with the environment, it's all there mathematically in the wave function. So there's a question of how what it's like to live in a world like this that has a branching structure, and the argument would be because our experiences themselves are made out of stuff in our brain and it's subject to similar constraints, we'll just experience moving along one branch. That's a funny thing to argue. There's a similar discussion. Imagine that you could clone people. So you had a machine that you could go into, and at the end of the machine, you have two copies of you come out. Neither copy is especially privileged. And then happen again and again. And what would it feel like to go into that machine? Well, if you go into the machine and you come out, you probably would just feel like you were in one of the two people that came out. And the other guy would feel like he was
his own person.
But you can't say which one you are going in. You step into the machine, you come out, you don't, there's no way of predicting, so to speak, which one of those two people you will be, whether you will come out the left hand or the right hand of the machine. So it's a very similar situation. You have this branching structure, and then there's the question of what it would feel like to experience living in that world. And the argument is that this accounts for the appearances that we have, tables and chairs. In each of these branches, we have the kind of quasi-classical world we see around us with tables and chairs. So it kind of does the job of accounting for appearances. I mean, these are, I think, difficult arguments because they're necessarily more philosophical because the fundamental axioms are mathematical axioms, but then you have to ask what it's like to live in this world. And that kind of question pertains to a very macroscopic effective level of description. You can trace it back to the fundamental equations, but it's not itself a fundamental way of talking about the world in some sense. So you can understand why this, why making sense of the many worlds interpretation has been the sort of task that philosophers have undertaken rather than physicists in recent years.
If I perform the experiment, right, in this interpretation, there are four possible outcomes exist at the same time.
Yeah.
I suppose there are two experiments, and if they observe the experimental result,
yeah,
if they discuss the result with each other, they should agree with it.
They will agree, and you can check that by putting them into the wave function, add two people in there, and you'll see that they're, in each term, they will agree. So in each branch, they'll have the same understanding, just because of the way the Hamiltonian works. So any conversation will be like it's in one branch that they might have. You can understand it in those terms. Yeah, I also find this problematic. It's a strange way of thinking about the world, and like I said, it's not a point of view I would advocate myself. But I think this part of the story is relatively coherent. I think you do see this branching structure is certainly there mathematically, and then it's just a question of what it would be like to live in that world. And I think you could imagine it's similar to the cloning example I gave that you would have to experience going into one of the other branches. I should mention incidentally, there's an approach to quantum theory called the consistent or decoherent histories approach, and it's a mathematically well worked out framework. If you're interested in asking these kinds of questions for a sort of history, a branching structure like this, that would be a very good framework in which to see how decoherence gives you a particular basis. I'm not going to discuss that approach here, though. Okay. So let me move on to the second problem. So that was the problem of picking out, accounting for the sort of branching structure that we see ourselves having this experience of tables and chairs and so on. The second problem, I think, is worse, and that's understanding probability. Well, maybe I should keep that. So the problem is that everything that has non-zero amplitude Definitely happens. Certainly happens. If anything has some non-zero amplitude, then that thing in this many walls approach certainly has a branch associated with it, and it certainly happens. So, for example, imagine you have this evolution, just take the first part. And what if beta, the amplitude is in front of the second term, is equal to 10 to the minus 100? So very small. Well, it doesn't matter. This branch would still be here, and you know, if I had more branches in this other branching structure, it doesn't matter how small the amplitude associated with any given branch. So here, associated with the A2 B2 branches, is this amplitude. It doesn't matter how small that is. That branch certainly happens. Furthermore, if you're in that branch, then it feels just as real as being in any other branch. Colors are just as bright. You don't feel drowsy because you have a low amplitude. There's no sense in which reality is less real in the branches that have low amplitude. If you're in that branch, it feels just like any other branch. So, given that this branch definitely happens, why don't we put the probability of seeing this? Why don't we put this probability equal to 1? Because it certainly happens. Well, if we do that, then we're not reproducing quantum theory. Quantum theory would say that the probability was the modulus of beta squared. Which is 10 to the minus 200. If I'm crossing the road and I think I have a probability of 10 to the minus 200 of getting hit by a car, then I'm going to take that risk and cross the road because, you know, typically I can live my whole life taking those kinds of risks without any serious consequences. On the other hand, if I think I have a probability of 1 of getting hit, I'm not going to cross the road. So it kind of matters. And what about if you say, well, there's another way of thinking about this is just to say, well, there's two possibilities. Both of them are equally real. I'm going to say the probability is 1/2. Why don't we say that? Why do we care about the amplitude? It doesn't have a direct, doesn't seem to have a direct relationship with our experience. The thing we see are things like A2. We don't see beta. Okay, any questions? No. Yeah, so that's part of the problem. We need to understand what we mean by probability in this context. And that's the kind of thing that David Wallace attempts to do, to make sense of this. Which probability? So one thing you could do is you could say, well, probability is a relative frequency. So I just repeat the experiment over and over again, and I measure how often something happens. So if you were to extend, so there you just have to extend this branching structure. So you had, maybe you kept doing the same, you know, you repeated the experiment many times. So you wouldn't do it on the same system. You'd have many copies of a system and repeat it. And you still get a branching structure because, you know, your quantum coin could come up heads or tails, and then heads or tails again, and heads or tails again. So at the end, you'd have a branching structure. So one of those branches would have heads on it for every single toss of the coin. Now, you'd like to say that that was extremely unlikely, but that branch is just as good as any other branch. So it's sort of problematic. And what if the coin is very strongly biased towards tails? What if it's a qubit which is pointing almost exactly along the one direction, has a very small projection into the zero projection, has a very small projection onto the zero basis. So then the amplitude associated with getting, I forget which way I said it, but the amplitude associated with getting heads every time is extremely small. But still, there's a branch associated with getting heads every time. So there's a lot of problems here. The approach that David Wallace takes is to, it's sort of, there's two sides to it. So in the first place, he uses a decision theory, a sort of decision theoretic framework. So this is something that's been developed independently of quantum theory. People are interested in how we make decisions and how we, how we use our beliefs in making decisions. So you can think about things like bets and so on and so forth, and how do you proceed to make decisions in the world generally, and in particular, how would you make decisions in the context of a branching structure like this? Okay. So I'm not going to give you the full proof or anything like that. I'm just going to try and just sketch the ideas that come into play here. So the idea is that we're going to use the notion of probability as a subjective measure of agents' beliefs. So this is subjective. There is later going to be a place for the notion of objective probabilities as well. But here it's just we have agents, they have some beliefs, and they make decisions based on their beliefs. So we're in the context of decision theory. So the idea is you can think in terms of bets and rewards. So we have some states S. Probably best to think of this as just a sort of classical kind of situation. We're just talking about decision theory, not in the context of quantum theory, especially. So these are states or outcomes, you might call them. So in the case of quantum theory, in the Everett interpretation, it would be which branch you find yourself in. What are the results on the measurement apparatuses? Then you make bets, and you get rewards. The reward might be something you want, like $10, or something you don't want, like having to give $10 to the other person. And in this kind of framework, you can, the bet is now a function on the outcomes of rewards. So you get a certain reward given a certain outcome. In this kind of framework, you can impose certain principles that you think are reasonable that might pertain to these kinds of bets. So certain principles of rationality. What would you do if you lived in a world like this, or any world where you have to make bets and make decisions and so on? How would you behave in a rational manner? So, for example, if you say that B1 is greater than B2, what that means is that the agent would prefer bet one over bet two. And also, B2 is greater than bet 3, then you would not want something like this to be true. So there's a whole set of principles like this that you can impose on this kind of structure. Decision theory, this kind of framework. And when you do that, you get certain theorems. So, for example, that there exists a unique function you can put on outcomes such that the thing adds up to one. The basic idea is that you can recover probability theory in this kind of decision theoretic framework. So I'm just sketching it. There's much more detail in reality. So what this is doing, this kind of decision theoretic framework, is it's telling you how to behave even in the face of a branching structure like this. If you have principles that you can use, then you can, for making decisions, then you have some idea how to behave. Yeah, I can't give you all the things here. You'd have to look at the paper. So there's a whole bunch of different items. I mean, I picked out the most reasonable one. So there's a whole bunch of less reasonable looking decision theoretic axioms that give you this kind of structure. So obviously, people who do this always choose enough to get the result they want, and you might accuse them of working backwards. But this is me. Okay. So that's good in the sense that it tells us how to behave, you know, it gives us some framework for making decisions in the world, you know, even in a structure like this. But then we need to, that doesn't quite do what we want, though, because we want to say that the probabilities are given by the Born rule, by the amplitude squared. There's a theorem that David Wallace has to that effect. I'm just going to tell you a few things about it. So there's this principle due to David Lewis, a philosopher, called the principal principle. Philosophy is kind of full of these colorful kind of names for things. And here's the idea. So here we're interested in forming a connection between subjective probabilities, which are our beliefs, and objective properties, objective probabilities, which are properties of the physical system, things that are taken to be actually real. So a rational agent who knows that the objective probability for something to happen is P is required to choose P as his subjective probability. Okay. So if we take this principle as being true, and if we can show that there's some sense in which the objective probabilities are given by the amplitude squared, then this will also be the numbers that we have to use when we make decisions. So in this paper with David Wallace, he has some theorem, which I'm not going to give you in any detail, just the main idea, that says that if you use these decision theoretic axioms and this principle, yes, you have a set of axioms that apply to this kind of branching structure of a decision theoretic nature, and you have this principle, then he claims to prove that you get the Born rule. doesn't. I mean, well, you could take it to be a definition of what you mean by rational agent. But yeah, I think it's perfectly reasonable to question whether this should be true or not. Here's an example of how you might question it. If I really genuinely believe that the Manuel's interpretation is correct, and then I think that if I step out into what looks like a very safe situation, you know, I'm crossing the road, but nevertheless, I think there's a very small amplitude that I'll get hit and killed by a truck, then because pain is just as real in every single branch, or death, I suppose, then I would be stuck. I wouldn't know what to do. So you know, the fact that there was some objective probability telling me that it was small might not convince me if I was very nervous to do that. So I think there is a problem, and you're right to be suspicious. But remember, I'm giving you the best version I can out there. There's a lot of criticisms of this work in the literature, incidentally. I think it's an area of active debate.
Don't really determine whether you cross the road or not. Like, there's a two price that you cross the road and you don't.
So one criticism here is that actually, if you look at the axioms here, everything is completely deterministic. You're not really making decisions as such. So why should you even worry about these things? But nevertheless, we have the feeling that we make decisions, and we apply probabilities to those senses that we have. And what we're trying to account for is this effective level of description, where we have this sense that we make decisions and we attach probabilities to them. And if we can do that, then we've accounted for the empirical success of quantum theory as well as the you know, that was the second thing I wanted to account for. So this, in a sense, this doesn't undermine at all the Everett people. What they're saying is that fundamentally, that's the world, and what we have to do is account for why this description is useful for describing for describing the effective observations we make in the world. So that, I think it's fine there. Okay, well, yeah, I think I'm over time, so I'll just finish off tomorrow talking about how Wallace claims to do that. And then I'll finish this topic on many worlds, just going through some of the criticisms of the many worlds approach. Okay.